On the football field, the action happens in the blink of an eye. It's like that off the field too when you've been injured. In a split second, your life is changed. Whether on the field or in the courtroom, when you've been injured, you need the right teammates by your side. You need Chase and Boscolo, a law firm willing to protect and fight for your rights. On the football field or in the courtroom, having the right team determines whether you win or lose. When injuries change your life, call Chase and Boscolo, trial lawyers that care. What Makes You Smile is brought to you by Dominion National. For anyone that needs dental and vision benefits, I have a one-stop shop for you. TeethKeeperSave.com. TeethKeeperSave.com offers dental and vision benefits for everyone with plans starting under $7 a month. Don't have benefits through your employer? Are you self-employed and need dental and vision benefits? TeethKeeperSave.com has various plans for individuals to choose from. Visit TeethKeeperSave.com today and enroll in minutes.
What's up, everybody? Redskins Talk, the podcast, is back. We are joined today by a very, very cool special guest. Kevin Seifert from ESPN is joining us. Kevin is a national NFL writer for ESPN and is going to take a few minutes to talk to us. What's up, man? How are you?
Pretty good. How are you, JP?
I am doing well. Thank you again for joining us. I'd like to get right into it. With the bye week, there was a lot of speculation about what happens with Kirk Cousins here in D.C.
Yeah.
And I'm curious kind of what you're hearing on the national level.
Well, I feel like everybody thinks that the jury is still out. And it kind of feels like where we were at the beginning of the season or at the end of last year when the sum total of Kirk Cousins' career was a few years of being having a lot of mistakes and a little bit of promise, but way too many turnovers to having a two-thirds of an unbelievable season and getting the team to the playoffs. But then running into the Redskins not necessarily being willing to commit to him long-term. And the idea that if the team that knows him the best and the people that are around him closest aren't yet totally sold, then why should anybody else be? And so that was kind of the thought process going into the season, and nothing that's happened so far has really dissuaded anybody. There's been some good moments, some big numbers, and then some other games that you wonder if it's really gonna work out in the long term. And so you also have to take in the context of the rest of the league and the quarterbacks around the league and knowing that there's more than a few teams who would be thrilled to have the problem or the issue that the Redskins have, but is their starter good enough to be paying him $20 million a year over the long term? There's a lot of teams that don't even have close to that even question about the guy they have starting right now. So you do have to take into account that context, but just by the way things go, you would think the second half of the season is going to really speak a lot, not only to his personal future as a starter and what and where he's going to be paid, but whether it'll be for the Redskins or somebody else.
Yeah, so a lot to digest there, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just kind of where the situation is. And I think the biggest thing that you brought up is Kirk is probably not a top 10 quarterback, but I do think he's top 15. Maybe he's top 12. And if he can get hot again, like he showed last year, maybe he cracks that top 10. I mean, you know, the second half of last season, his numbers were on par with anybody. Now,
right.
was that kind of a snapshot of somebody he isn't, or is that him at his best? I guess we'll find out. But because of the lack of quarterbacks in the NFL, do you think the Skins would be a little crazy to let him walk? Or do you think the idea of, hey, instead of investing this cash, we are going to really get our defense really good, and then we can plug in a journeyman or a young guy that can move the ball?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things there. I mean, one is, you know, it's easy for us on the outside to say that why would the Redskins try to get a starter that is going to be demonstrably better than Kirk Cousins, knowing how hard it is to find somebody in the draft and how rarely somebody becomes available in free agency or a trade. You know, you look at all these teams that for generations have been, I mean, look at the Cleveland Browns and how hard it's been for them to find anybody that comes anywhere close to Kirk Cousins. And look at the Jaguars. Look at you know, the Rams right now. Even though they have Jared Goff on the roster, their struggles up until this point to find somebody. So, you know, it's easy from the outside for us to say, well, why in the world would you not want to commit? But you never know how people think. You know, Jay Gruden has had a lot of success with quarterbacks, yet he got Andy Dalton to play at a pretty high level when not everybody thought that Andy Dalton was a NFL starter. And he's done the same for Kirk Cousins. So sometimes teams look at it and they say, hey, you know, we've got a guy who can in a system that can support any, you know, a quarterback at any level. And so I'm not saying that's the right thought. I'm not saying that they should be thinking that. And I don't know if that is what they're thinking, but you see that happen sometimes, that teams take into account their program and their coaches and their assets and think, you know, we don't necessarily have to just succumb to conventional wisdom here. And so I think that while I could look at it from the outside and say, how in the world would they want to start over, given just the success that they've had and how long it took just to get Kirk Cousins to this point. But you just never know how they think.
Right. Well, and it's funny, you name, obviously, teams with terrible quarterback situations, the Browns, the Rams. The Skins have had terrible quarterbacking for the better part of 20 years. You know, I mean, there was the blip on the radar with RG3 and, you know, maybe Gus Frerotte gave them a good year here. But, like, I mean, they've been in that same quarterback abyss. But to your point, when you watch Kirk play, I don't know how much of the Skins you're able to watch, because I know you're watching all over the league. They don't score in the red zone, and there's a lack of big plays. And I'm curious what you think, what you hear, because I know what I attribute it to. I think you've got to have big plays to open up your offense in the red zone a little bit more. They become very predictable when they get inside the 20. And what they like to do on kind of shallow crossing underneath stuff, that real estate just bogs down when they get packed in. I'm curious your thoughts on the red zone struggles.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, it's been hard to pin. It's always hard to pin red zone problems on a quarterback unless he's so cautious and so conservative and so worried about making a mistake that he just won't. Take chances when he's that close. And I don't know if that's the case with Kirk Cousins. More typically than not, red zone issues are attributed to play calling and scheme or some personnel hole that makes it easier for defenses to line up against him. You know, maybe they're not worried about the run. A team could not have a receiver who can just go up and get a ball. There's no concern about the fade, or there's no big tight end who can catch it over the top. And, you know, I don't know that that necessarily applies to the Redskins, but those are the kind of things that more often contribute to red zone issues than something inherently wrong with the quarterback. And he's got the arm, he's got the intelligence to read defenses. He knows, I think, where to go with the ball more often than not. And I don't think he's like over the top conservative. Maybe, you know, you've seen more and could think differently, but I guess I would, if we were gonna blame Kirk Cousins for red zone issues, I'd want to see a list of things that he specifically does wrong for it to be attributed to him, as opposed to more of a schematic and play calling issue.
All right, so a couple things there I want to follow up on. One, the fade route in DC has become a 4-letter word, because they ran it a lot early, especially when Josh Doctson, the two games they had out of him, you could tell, talk about trying to force something. They really wanted to show his athleticism in the end zone. What do you think of the fade just as a goal line pattern?
Yeah, if you have a guy who can do it, it's great. If you have a guy who's bigger than everybody or has longer arms, and, you know, whether it's a Julio Jones or an A.J. Green or somebody, if you have the personnel, it works. You know, if you try to force it to a guy who either doesn't have the physical attributes to do it, or just isn't experienced enough, and that might be the case with Doctson, it's a low percentage play. I mean, because you have to put the ball in a precise point, and you have to hope that the receiver knows how to hold off the defender, and you have to hope that the receiver got the right matchup against the shorter guys. There's a lot of things that go into it, but when you have it down, it's great. And so whether, you know, they have the personnel and the right people to run that, you know, I guess is up for everyone to debate, but I don't think it's like an outdated concept, or I don't think it's something that shouldn't be run. It just should be run when you have the right people to do it.
I think if they're going to run it, and they certainly run it, they should be running it to Jordan Reed. The Pats do that really well. I don't know that it's a technically a proper fade, like in the route tree, but just Jordan Reed is bigger than everyone. Just put it up high and let him get it. The Pats do it with Gronk incredibly well, and Reed's not the physical presence Gronk is, but Reed's pretty impressive. I think that would work.
Yeah, and the Vikings, and you'll see him this weekend, the Vikings have a guy in Kyle Rudolph who's a tall and is only, I think he's 6'6", or almost 6'7", just, and then huge long arms and huge hands, that I've seen him make plenty of catches, you know, flat-footed over top of guys who are jumping and never bring the ball down. And so that, if you have a guy who can do that, it's unbeatable. You know, whether they think that Jordan Reed can do that or they don't feel confident, I'm not sure, but that's the analysis that they have to make.
Very interesting. We'll get to Kyle Rudolph in 1 second. But so you talked about the scheme offensively. I think Jay Gruden runs great offense. I think if you look, there's always open receivers. Yeah. Whether or not Kirk goes downfield enough is perhaps a different debate. He runs Kirk gets rid of the ball quickly, and they are always moving it. So I think it's tough to criticize Kirk as far as running the offense. But between Gruden and McVay, what do you think of the conceptually kind of the West Coast proxy they run? And then how serious is the McVay will be a head coach talk elsewhere?
I think, you know, and I think going back to Cincinnati, Jay Gruden, you know, when you put Cincinnati and then you staple it together to Washington and you look at his resume, I mean, I think there's a pretty clear sense, you know, obviously he's had decent personnel in both places, but there's a pretty clear sense that he's got some, you know, sophistication to the way he goes about putting together an offense, to the way he game plans to, against other defenders, to the way other defenses, to the way that he has answers to most everything that you might see. And so that, I think there's a lot of respect nationally for the offense that he's put together and for the commitment that he. It was pretty obvious right away that he thought Kirk Cousins was a better fit for what he wanted to do than Robert Griffin. And I thought that was maybe a coach making the mistake of trying to find players to fit his scheme as opposed to finding a scheme that fit the players. But ultimately, it's been borne out to be accurate. You know, that was he was right to push for Kirk over or to elevate Kirk over Robert Griffin, and that story has been told many times. But I think there's a pretty decent level of respect for his, you know, him as an offensive schemer and probably more of that than as a head coach overall. But obviously to have an offense that can score a lot of points is a big key to having a winning program instead. As far as McVay, I think there's a lot of interest in him. There's always, you know, people are always going to be attracted to a newer name or a hot name or a name associated with a dynamic offense. But I think there's also a sense that a lot of what's going on in Washington is Jay Gruden at least initiated, if not totally responsible for. So I'm sure that as a key member of an offense that over time does pretty well, that Sean will get plenty of attention and he'll have a chance to get in front of owners at some point to state his case. I don't know that that's going to be like this year or not. But at some point it'll happen. I'm sure he'll at least get that opportunity to start interviewing.
Yeah. The thing that I think is kind of forgotten about now, because he was proven right, or I'd say he's proven right. I mean, Robert didn't work out in Cleveland with the injury. I'm not sure it would have worked out anyway. But Gruden really put his career on the line there, because if that went bad with Kirk going to the starting quarterback, that would have gone really bad. I mean, if Kirk...
That was it, yeah.
And if you think about it, you know, last year, that Tampa game, I still think there was a reason Kirk was so excited leaving that field, because if that Tampa game... You know, they were down big at halftime. That would have been another bad loss for them. And that could have changed the entire complexion of last season and then whatever happens for the rest of the year. So Gruden deserves not just the foresight to that, hey, this guy runs my offense well, but also kind of the guts it took to make that call against, you know, of probably ownership that liked Robert Griffin, if we're going to believe all that we've heard at this point.
Well, I mean, there's whether it was ownership or what, I mean, there was a lot of institutional support in most organizations for a guy that not only taken high in the draft, but given how many assets they gave up to get that high pick. I mean, whether it was the situation in Washington or ownership or just really any team, I mean, it would be tough for any coach to come into any organization in that situation that had given up so many draft picks to move up and acquire somebody to buck that and eventually not only get their way, but have it proved out to be the right path. And so, that's one situation that I don't even think is unique to the Redskins. That would have been tough for any coach anywhere.
What? Not to mention huge fan support for Griffin. Huge fan support.
Oh, and for good reason. I mean, he had built it up in that first year. I mean, that he wrote that for a long time, and that's kind of how those things work usually.
Right. All right. Let's go to the Vikings. Obviously, you're all over the map in the teams you cover, but you do live in Minneapolis. You probably know the Vikings as well as any team in the NFL. They were, you know, I feel like a month ago, various power rankings had the Vikings one or two with the Pats. What is happening up there?
Yeah, the first answer to that question is they've run into just an enormously unfortunate run of injuries to key people. I mean, everybody knows Teddy Bridgewater goes down in a random preseason practice with no contact and tears up his knee. Who knows if he'll ever, when and if he'll be ready to play again. Week two, they have to go out and draft and get Sam Bradford, who is better at Teddy Bridgewater at some things and not as good as him as others. They go out in week two, and Adrian Peterson suffers what appears to be a season-ending knee injury. The same game was the last time that their left tackle played. Matt Khalil, he's out for the year, and then they lose their right tackle a couple weeks later. So you're talking about an offense that has lost, that was already struggling to figure out what they were going to be because of the Teddy Bridgewater injury, have lost their quarterback, their Hall of Fame running back, and both tackles. And this past week against the Lions, they played without one of their other offensive linemen. So they're down three starting offensive linemen. That's a difficult problem for anybody. And that's, you know, they were fortunate to rack up those five wins prior to that, and now they had a little bit of a losing streak, and it created enough tension in the building that their offense coordinator, Norv Turner, the former Redskins coach, bailed after seven games, and that's a relatively unprecedented situation.
That was
so
nuts.
They're dealing with all those things.
Yeah.
And that's probably a little bit of a longer answer, but of what has happened to them.
So you're saying the Redskins fans shouldn't complain about not having Trent Williams for a month, considering what's going
on
in Minnesota?
I mean, it's tough for any team to lose that position, but anytime you think you've got it bad, you can look around and probably find somebody who has it worse.
Certainly. So the strength of the Vikings is obviously the defense.
Yeah.
The defense is still pretty much healthy and still a formidable unit, though.
Yeah, they've had an injury or two here and there. But for the most part, all their key guys are playing, Mike Zimmer is the head coach, but he's also the sort of the de facto defensive coordinator. And he actually calls all the defensive plays, and he's always been really good at that. They're pretty good at disguising things and pulling new things out of old formations and all those sort of things that made him a head coaching candidate in the first place. And so they play at a pretty high level. And I know they've lost three games in a row, and they gave up that that late lead against the Lions. But for the most part, they have more than carried this team. And had they gotten more support from the offense in the past few games, things would have been a lot better for them.
So what the hell happened with Norv Turner? That was so weird.
I mean, you know, it'll go down as one of the bigger mysteries right now. But I think what happened is Mike Zimmer hired Norv Turner sort of be the head coach of the offense. You know, he had a lot of respect for him, and Norv Turner's had a lot of success. And he basically said, you deal with the offense. I'm going to work on getting this defense. Defense is my expertise. I'm going to work on getting this defense straight. And so they sort of had this this situation where that Zimmer wasn't even really that involved in letting Norv Turner kind of just do his thing. And so that sounds good in theory, but you always need to have the checks and balances of any leadership situation. And sometimes you just need to come in and say, hey, you need to think about this, or you need to do that. And he never really was in that position. And then when things got really rough this year with all the injuries, and they had to acquire a quarterback that probably wouldn't have been a Norv Turner type quarterback in Sam Bradford, because he was the best guy out there.
Right.
I think Norv was starting to feel like, he was not being put in a position to succeed, and that the players he had been given and some of the staff changes that Mike Zimmer had made in the previous years were really kind of working against him. I don't know that that's a full explanation of what happened and why that would make him just walk out, but I think he felt pretty certain that he was not going to be able to fix this offense given all the injuries, and that was that.
Yeah, I mean, and at some point, a guy like Norv has been in the NFL long enough that he might just say, F it, you know? If it's not going to be my ship. It's an interesting situation. So what do you expect to happen, Skins-Vikings, on Sunday?
Yeah, I think it's a very winnable game for the Redskins. I haven't decided who I'm picking yet, but it's a very winnable game, because you don't have to score, right now at least, you don't have to score a ton of points on the Vikings to beat them. The Lions, they were at 13 until the latest Matthew Stafford comeback. They got the 16 at halftime.
Stafford
at the end of regulation, and then they won in overtime. And so, the Redskins don't even have to have a bang up game against this defense to be able to beat the Vikings, because I'm not sure that they have yet figured out where they're going to go on offense, or no matter what they're going to do, or who the coach is, or who's calling the plays, or what the plays are. When you lose that many key players, there's not but so many different ways you can go. So I don't know that this is ever going to be an offense that's going to be scoring 25 or 30 points. So I think the Redskins have an excellent chance to as long as they can score enough points, to win this game.
Yeah, and that was kind of my thought. I was on radio here in D.C. yesterday, and I said, I honestly think if they can get to 17, 20 points, and granted they don't give up like a defensive touchdown or a special teams touchdown, I think 20 points wins this game. So I know you got to run, but you have some DC. You've been here, Washington Times, for a while. Anything you miss about this area?
Anything what?
Anything you miss about the DMV?
I miss a lot of things. I'm looking at the long-term weather forecast here in Minnesota, and I'm seeing a polar vortex being forecast by the people in by the Farmer's Almanac, and I'm thinking a mid-Atlantic winter wouldn't be bad right now. That's for sure.
I tell you
but
what,
given the state of national politics, I'm not totally upset to be away from the federal government. I don't think.
Oh my God, dude! I get just walking around D.C. is going to be such a mess the next couple days.
That's what makes it a great city, but also a tough one to live in. Sometimes.
Yeah, but so we were looking. Rich Taylor and I were looking at kind of playoff projections, and obviously it's too early for any of it. But if the season ended whenever we were looking at it, the Skins would be traveling to Minnesota for a wild card game. And I was like, man, I've always wanted to go to Minneapolis, but not exactly in January.
No, and the Super Bowl is going to be here in 2 years, and so that is usually the coldest week of the year at the end of January, first week of February. So fortunately, it's an indoor stadium, and most of Minneapolis is connected by skyways, so you don't even have to go outside. So that's the positive part of it.
How cool is that new stadium? It looks awesome.
It is. It's remarkable. I mean, they did a great job making it a unique building to Minnesota, very functional building. They'll be able to use it year-round. High school football tournaments will be there. They've had concerts there. It's going to be in use a lot. It's not just the 10 weeks a year football stadium that you see. And it's very unique and a landmark. And so, I don't know, it's a separate issue about whether you think $1 billion or $500 or $600 million of public money should be spent on a $1 billion stadium or not, but it was. And so at least they made something pretty decent out of it.
Right. My sister lives in San Diego. and she was, you know, the ballot yesterday was about the Chargers stadium, and she was asking me what I thought, and I was like, I honestly don't know, because I do think there's value in having cool downtown stadiums, and there probably is reciprocal value to a community, but at some point, folks got to pay for their own stuff too. So
I don't think that the NFL or the Vikings are going to be losing any money on that deal.
Right. Kevin, thank you so much, folks. Everybody, follow Kevin Seifert at Seifert ESPN. Is there any you writing books or anything? Anything we can plug for you?
Nothing that dramatic. Just plugging away at ESPN.com.
Cool. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking some time with us.
Okay, JP.
Okay, see ya.
I owe you a beer.
Orsman opened its first car dealership in 1921. Now, over 100 years and many dealerships later, Orsman of Virginia can proudly say that when it comes to your car buying needs, if you want it, we've got it. Saving, selection, and service? Check. Lifetime engine guarantees and car washes? Check. Loaner cars and free Virginia inspections? Check and check. See, over the past 100 years, we've learned that to succeed in business, we've got to keep our customers happy. And that's the Orsman story.
Orsman Chantilly Toyota. Let's ride together.
Orsman opened its first car dealership in 1921. Now, over 100 years and many dealerships later, Orsman of Virginia can proudly say that when it comes to your car buying needs, if you want it, we've got it. Saving, selection, and service? Check. Lifetime engine guarantees and car washes? Check. Loaner cars and free Virginia inspections? Check and check. See, over the past 100 years, we've learned that to succeed in business, we've got to keep our customers happy. And that's the Orsman story.
Orsman Ford Lincoln. Let's ride together.